Hello and welcome to Cambridge Indie Media's first radio programme. Coming up later, we have a report from Fallujah in Iraq and some information about the G8, who are meeting in Gleneagles in Scotland later this year. But first, after some music, an introduction to what Indie Media is.
This is how it started. It's not hard to understand. From coast to coast, they're lying at a CEO's command. From nationalist public radio, CNN and NBC, Big Brother spewing propaganda from the disinformation ministry. They say the economy is booming. We hear the homeless beggars cry. They say we help poor countries. We see bombs falling from the skies. Reality doesn't exist, they're trying to say. But some of us decided there is another way. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Someone got a transmitter, started up a station. Then the idea spread right across the nation. Like the land and water, the air must be free. So let us shout together, fuck the FCC. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. And we'll do it all together in a grassroots style, tearing down the fences throughout this whole square mile. It's the new town meeting, it's the way the news should be. The rulers call it chaos, we say it's democracy. So when you turn on the radio and you've had it with this shit, from 88 to 107 makes you wanna have a fit. When you listen to the music and it's all the same pop song, start up a pirate station, 'cause that's where you belong. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. Seize the airwaves, seize the time. 'Cause lying to the people is the real crime. When it's all owned by corporations and theirs is the only word, we will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard. We will seize the airwaves, speak freely and be heard.
Can you give us a bit of an introduction to Indie Media?
So Indie Media is a group of people around the world that is committed to reporting news that is usually not covered by commercial or government-controlled media outlets. In particular, we cover news about social movements, protests, open meetings and discussions that very often feature very little or only in a negative way in more mainstream media.
What kind of format is it done by?
So, Indie Media is mainly a site on the internet that is open 24 hours a day, all days. And people can actually send their news straight to the newswires without having the mediation of an editor or anyone else to censor them. We have a very minimalistic editorial policy, just to avoid having racist comments or sexist comments, but otherwise any news that is of social relevance just gets straight through. During major protests, we also set up physical media centers. These are places where activists all around can come, give their news, provide footage, provide sound, make live streams that are then translated and relayed all around the world. So this is the physical side of Indie Media. Behind the websites and also these media centers, there are collectives that are functioning all around the year, and they provide a kind of political backbone. We are maintaining the infrastructure, and we are also doing outreach for people to actually give their news and send their news.
What kind of news that you mostly report then?
Most of the time we report about social movements. So we are reporting about protests very often. We are reporting about meetings and campaigns that are happening in towns all around England, but also more major protests that are happening around major events like the G8 or the World Trade Organization meetings, and of course the Bush inauguration lately.
Can you give us a bit of a history about how this organization came about?
Indymedia as a network started in 1999 during the World Trade Organization meeting that happened in Seattle. What happened there is that a group of activists, having been quite upset in the past by the very negative way in which the protests are portrayed and the fact that the issues that are actually at heart never get through to be aired around the world's media, decided as a form of action, as a form of political action, to just create an independent media outlet and broadcast through the internet, but also by making videos and radio shows such as this one, the other side of the picture that people never see, what do people protest about, what are the issues that they have at heart, and what is their everyday reality that is never really seen. Indymedia since then has grown a lot. Now there are 140 sites around the world, mostly linked to cities, but also some projects like climate change. So in Britain, there are about 11 collectives around the country, in major cities like London and now Birmingham, but also smaller places like Cambridge and Oxford. And we report mostly news about what is happening in the community, small campaigns, issues that are of interest to other community or that are not yet big enough to be covered by other local media.
What would you see as the main differences between indie media and the more established media centres?
So with indie media, everybody can send news. We have set up these websites, and everybody can just log in and very easily, without much technical knowledge, just send news in the form of text, audio or video. So basically there is no such thing as an editor in the conventional way. When there have to be editorial policies, they are done openly and democratically. So everybody is welcome to participate in the editorial policy making, and usually everybody is happy with the final outcome. Aside from producing the news in an open and democratic way, we also run the Indymedia organization as transparently as we can. Most of the organizing, in order to put up events or in order to manage the content, is done through open mailing lists and physical discussions every fortnight. So it is a radically different news medium in that everybody can actually participate, and it is actually a democratically run media outlet.
So how can you get involved in Indymedia?
The best way to get involved with Indymedia is by sending your news. We are particularly interested about community news and news that are happening around where you're living. So it's very easy. You just go to cambridge.indymedia.org.uk on the internet and press the publish button and just fill in the form. It's very easy and very direct. We also organize film screenings about progressive issues and with progressive documentaries. And the best way to find out about when they're held is to just look on our website. Finally, another way of getting involved with Indymedia Cambridge is help us organize. After all, we're all volunteers, and if you can even just put a poster around where you're living or help us set up events, parties, fundraisers, that would be fantastic.
This is a story that was reported on zmag.org on the 9th of February 2005 and was written by Dahar Jamil. Stories from Fallujah. These are the stories that will continue to emerge from the rubble of Fallujah for years, no, for generations. Speaking on condition of anonymity, the doctor sits with me in a hotel room in Amman, where he is now a refugee. He's spoken about what he saw in Fallujah in the UK, and now is under threat by the US military if he returns to Iraq. I started speaking about what happened in Fallujah during both sieges in order to raise awareness, and the Americans raided my house 3 times, he says, talking so fast I can barely keep up. He is driven to tell what he's witnessed, and as a doctor working inside Fallujah, he has video and photographic proof of all that he tells me. I entered Fallujah with a British medical and humanitarian convoy in the end of December, and stayed working until the end of January, he explains. But I was in Fallujah before that to work with people and see what their needs were, so I was in there since the beginning of December. When I asked him to explain what he saw when he first entered Fallujah in December, he says it was like a tsunami struck the city. Fallujah is surrounded by refugee camps where people are living in tents and old cars, he explains. It reminded me of Palestinian refugees. I saw children coughing because of the cold, and there were no medicines. Most everyone left their houses with nothing and no money, so how can they live depending only on humanitarian aid? The doctor says that in one refugee camp in the north area of Fallujah, there were 1,200 students living in seven tents. The disaster caused by this siege is so much worse than the first one, which I witnessed firsthand, he says. And then he tells me he'll use one story as an example. One story is of a young girl who is 16 years old, he says, of one of the testimonies he videotaped recently. She stayed for 3 days with the bodies of her family, who were killed in their home. When the soldiers entered, she was in her home with her father, mother, 12-year-old brother and two sisters. She watched the soldiers enter and shoot her mother and father directly, without saying anything. The girl managed to hide behind the refrigerator with her brother and witnessed the war crimes firsthand. They beat her two sisters, then shot them in the head, he said. After this, her brother was enraged and ran at the soldiers while shouting at them, so they shot him dead. She continued hiding after the soldiers left and stayed with her sisters because they were bleeding but still alive. She was too afraid to call for help because she feared the soldiers would come back and kill her as well. She stayed for 3 days with no water and no food. Eventually, one of the American snipers saw her and took her to hospital, he added, before reminding me again that he had all of her testimony documented on film. He briefly told me of another story he documented of a mother who was in her home during the siege. On the fifth day of the siege, her home was bombed, and the roof fell on her son, cutting his legs off, he says, while using his hands to make cutting motions on his legs. For hours, she couldn't go outside because they announced that anyone going in the street would be shot, so all she could do was wrap his legs and watch him die before her eyes. He pauses for a few deep breaths, then continues. All I can say is that Fallujah is like it was struck by a tsunami. There weren't many families in there after the siege, but they had absolutely nothing. The suffering was beyond what you can imagine. When the Americans finally let us in, people were fighting just for a blanket. One of my colleagues, Dr. Saleh Aswali, he was speaking so angrily about them. He was in the main hospital when they raided it at the beginning of the siege. They entered the theatre room when they were working on a patient. He was there because he's an anesthesiologist. They entered with their boots on, beat the doctors and took them out, leaving the patient on the table to die. This story has already been reported in the Arab media. The doctor tells me of the bombing of the Hay Nazal clinic during the first week of the siege. This contained all the foreign aid and medical instruments we had. All the US military commanders knew this because we told them about it so they wouldn't bomb it. But this was one of the clinics bombed, and in the first week of the siege, they bombed it 2 times. He then adds, of course they targeted all our ambulances and doctors. Everyone knows this. The doctor tells me he and some other doctors are trying to sue the US military for the following incident, for which he has testimonial evidence on tape. It is a story I was told by several refugees in Baghdad as well, at the end of the last November, when the siege was still in progress. During the second week of the siege, they entered and announced that all families have to leave their homes and meet an insurrection in the street while carrying a white flag. They gave them 72 hours to leave, and after that they would be considered an enemy, he says. We documented this story with a video. A family of 12, including a relative and his oldest child, who was 7 years old. They heard this instruction, so they left with all their food and money they could carry, and white flags. When they reached the intersection, where the families were accumulating, they heard someone shouting, "Now," in English, and shooting started everywhere. The family was all carrying white flags, as instructed, according to the young man who gave his testimony. Yet he watched his mother and father shot by snipers, his mother in the head and his father shot in the heart. His two aunts were shot, then his brother was shot in the neck. The man stated that when he raised himself from the ground to shout for help, he was shot in the side. After some hours, he raised his arm for help, and they shot his arm, continues the doctor. So after a while, he raised his hand, and they shot his hand. A 6-year-old boy of the family was standing over the bodies of his parents, crying, and he too was then shot. Anyone who raised up was shot, as the doctor, and then added again that he had photographs of the dead, as well as photos of the gunshot wounds of the survivors. Once it grew dark, some of them, along with this man, who spoke with me, with his child and his sister-in-law and sister, managed to crawl away after it got dark. They crawled to a building and stayed for 8 days. They had one cup of water and gave it to the child. They used cooking oil to put on their wounds, which were of course infected, and found some roots and dates to eat. He stops here. His eyes look around the room as cars pass by outside on wet streets, water hissing under the tyres. He left Fallujah at the end of January, so I asked him what it was like when he left recently. Now maybe 25% of the people have returned, but there are still no doctors. The hatred now for legions against every American is incredible, and you cannot blame them. The humiliation at the checkpoints is only making people angrier, he tells me. I've been there, and I saw that anyone who even turns their head is threatened and hit by both American and Iraqi soldiers alike. One man did this, and when the Iraqi soldier tried to humiliate him, the man took a gun of a nearby soldier and killed two ING, so then of course he was shot. The doctor tells me they are keeping people in the line for several hours at a time, in addition to the US military making propaganda films of the situation. And I've seen them use the media, and on January the 2nd, at the North Checkpoint, in the north part of Fallujah, they were giving people $200 per family to return to Fallujah so they can film them in the line, when actually, at the time, no one was returning to Fallujah, he says. It reminds me of a story my colleague told me of what he saw in January. At that time, a CNN crew was escorted in by the military to film street cleaners who were brought in as props and soldiers handing out candy to children. You must understand the hatred that has been caused. It has gotten more difficult for Iraqis, including myself, to make the distinction between the American government and the American people, he tells me. His story is like countless others. My cousin was a poor man in Fallujah, he explains. He walked from his house to work and back while living with his wife and five daughters. In July of 2003, American soldiers entered his house and woke them all up. They dragged them into the main room of the house and executed my cousin in front of his family. Then they simply left. He pauses, then holds up his hands and asks, "Now, how are these people going to feel about Americans?"
I'm your masters of war. You that build the big guns. You that build the death planes. You that build all the bombs. You that hide behind walls. You that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes. And I see through your brain, like I see through the water that runs down my drain. You fasten all the triggers for the others to fire. And then you sit back and watch when the death count gets higher. You hide in your mansion while the young people's blood flows out of their bodies and is buried in the mud. You've thrown the worst fear that can ever be hurled. Fear to bring children into the world. Before threatening my baby, unborn and unnamed. You ain't worth the blood that runs in your veins. How much do I know? But to talk out of turn, you might say that I'm young. You might say I'm unlearned. But there's one thing I know. I'm younger than you. That even Jesus would never forgive what you do. Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could? I think you will find, when your death takes its toll, all the money you made will never buy back your soul. And I hope that you die, and your death will come soon. I follow your casket by the pale afternoon, and I watch while you're lowered down to your deathbed. And I stand over your grave till I'm sure that you're dead.
The G8, or Group of Eight, is a group of the seven most economically powerful countries: France, United States, Britain, Germany, Japan, Italy, and Canada, known collectively as the G7 plus Russia. The current president of the European Union also participates. The G8 was established to realign national social structures in accordance with the growth and dominance of global capital. The group has met every year since the six largest economies first met in 1975 in Rambouillet, France, to discuss the economic crisis created when the United States abandoned the gold standard, resulting in floating currencies. Canada joined in 1976, the European Union in 1977, and the participation of Russia was included over a period of time starting informally in 1994 and concluding with formal inclusion in 1997 at the Summit of the Eight in Denver. While initially focused on microeconomic and trade issues, political issues such as security, development, nuclear safety and terrorism have over the years become more important. The G7 continues to meet without Russia before each G8 summit to discuss economic issues. The G8 has also created a series of ministerial forums which meet at the summit and throughout the year on specific topics, including trade ministers, foreign ministers, finance ministers, environment ministers and labour ministers. The G8 considers itself a discussion forum only. However, nothing happens in formal international organisations such as the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank without the prior consent or active support of the G8. The overall direction of policy which comes out of the G8 also has a significant impact on these organisations. The G7 countries control the most powerful international financial institutions. Voting power at the World Bank and the IMF is determined by the level of a nation's financial contribution, $1, one vote, and the G7 holds a total of 45%, which results in an effective veto on decisions. The true power at the World Trade Organization lies with the informal quad countries of the United States, Canada, Japan and the European Union. The G8 meets every summer in advance of the September meetings of the World Bank and IMF and the November ministerial of the World Trade Organization, so that decisions made at the G8 impact the policies set at these meetings. The G8 is essentially a means in which the power of a few individuals can be maintained with the consent and collaboration of both capitalism and state institutions, and that power used to control, manipulate, and ultimately govern as a global authority.
To maintain social order, these decision makers rely on coercion, compliance, and ultimately the use of state forces to retain their authority. Under the cover of the war against terrorism, the Group of Eight will take any opportunity to prescribe a powerful police force in order to keep its stranglehold around the borders of the free world. It is not often that the notions of political asylum and freedom of movement are allowed to circulate around the corridors of power. Anti-immigration politics have been responsible for several hundred deaths of all ages and serve the mafia networks which feed the traffic of individuals and maintain a state of tension. The G8 leaders can also be found at the UN Security Council or at the heart of NATO, whose role is to organise the militarisation of the world and to defend the economic interests of the multinationals. And so, the G8 fulfills a tripartite mission of organising the economy, the police and the military, allowing them to maintain their hold over entire populations. The mobilisation of organised masses outside the summits of this world government makes it necessary to alter our communication network. They need to disarm their critics by integrating the least radical fringe of the movement and criminalising the actions of the most subversive elements. All the major powers fear popular direct action, the autonomy of social movement, the means of functioning at odds with the logic of power.
From the 6th to the 8th of July 2005, the G8, the rulers of eight of the world's most powerful economies and countries, return to Europe for their annual summit, which takes place at Gleneagles Hotel in Perthshire, Scotland. Groups and movements from across Europe, from the Assembly of Social Movements at the European Social Forum to those involved in the global grassroots network People's Global Action, have called for the summit to be massively disrupted. There are calls for people to converge in Scotland and on the 6th of July for action to be taken simultaneously in villages, towns and cities worldwide. In the UK, dozens of grassroots autonomous groups have created the Dissent Anti-Capitalist Network, which is organising radical resistance to the G8 summit and building alternatives to the current social order. In 1975, amidst a global oil crisis and a general upsurge in struggle, the G8 was born. Its intended role was as a crisis manager for capitalism, a forum in which consensus could be constructed on issues of importance to capital such as world trade, migration, oil supplies and security. It was designed as a tool for the creation and maintenance of stability, a stability of exploitation. All around us we see the impacts and effects of a system to which the G8 attempts to bring longevity. Mindless work, war, famine and destroyed ecologies. A system whose very survival means that none of us can live our lives to their true potential. A system that is resisted daily, everywhere.
This resistance often takes place away from the spotlight of the world's media. It manifests itself in individual acts of refusal, in sporadic collective withdrawals of consent, and, occasionally, in spectacular movements of mass rebellion. The 2005 G8 Summit provides the opportunity for exactly such a moment. The neoliberal project, Capitalism with its Gloves On, has been fiercely contested across the world, with struggles taking on almost as many different forms as they are numerous. The social and material conditions from which they have arisen, the demands made and alternatives demonstrated have been similarly varied, yet they have been united in reclaiming a sense of humanity to our existences from the many-sided social and ecological crisis within which we find ourselves today. These struggles and the hopes they express will certainly continue and likely multiply in their diversity as we fight for a world in which many worlds are possible. Resistance to the summit itself will be a reflection of this diversity. For some, the priority will be upon stopping the so-called world leaders and their entourages from meeting and attempting to dismantle the capitalist infrastructure that facilitates war, climate change and famine. For others, it is critical to delegitimize this bankrupt system by symbolically shattering the fake global unity the G8 promotes, especially in a rich state like the UK. Then, there are others still who care very little about the G8 itself, and much more of what we, as a global movement, do about expanding our own possibilities, living together, if only temporarily, with no limits. Recognizing this multiplicity, Dissent has begun organizing convergent spaces in which our resistance can flourish. Plans are afoot for spaces to be available for the month before the summit and during it, so we can collectively make our desires real. These will be self-managed zones, aiming to house and feed many thousands, whilst providing living examples of leaderless, free, and ecological communities.
Corporations, It's a really great day to sidestep nations who just get in the way because their people have too much of a say. But boys, we have got the answer. Free trade. It sounds really good. It spells freedom for the corporate brotherhood. And you need us in your neighborhood with new global employers. Oh, honey, let's join the WTO. Make lots of money at the WTO. We can change a few laws, fix democracy's flaws. It's the corporate new world order. Unions are a pain in the ass. They cause problems, give executives gas. They want fair wages for the people who work. What? A bunch of jerks, poor children, must be taught how to live. They need employment, so they'll have money to give to corporations who are making their clothes. The child labor laws must go. Oh, honey, let's join the WTO. Make lots of money at the WTO. We can change a few laws, fix democracy's flaws. It's the corporate new world order. People of America fret, turtles and dolphins who are caught in the nets. But it takes money to free all these pests, and that's a free trade barrier. Clean air is a luxury for some, but let's be fair, it's not for everyone, cause goods are cheaper. If you release a little scum, defend your freedom of pollution. Oh, honey, let's join the WTO. Make lots of money at the WTO. We can change a few laws, fix democracy's flaws. It's the carbon. Make lots of money.